That's right. So I'm going to present some results from an ongoing work with Greg Moore and Ed Whitman on massive Chukumachu theories in two dimensions and their brain, their PPS states and their D-brains. So essentially, the purpose of the project is to understand a bit better the categorical properties of these massive Chukumachu theories, so the BPS states and all the brains. The main motivation, at least one of the motivations, is to understand the if there is some categorical extension of the world crossing formula, which controls the behavior of the BPS particles or these theories. And also, second motivation was to develop some tools which could be then used in understanding better Edward construction of homological knot invariants from gauge theory. So when I'm speaking about massive Chukumachu theories, essentially and brains, I'm essentially referring exactly to the kind of theories and brains that people are putting on spheres or hemispheres in a supersymmetric way. So I'm referring to some theory which has a Chukumachu super Poincaré algebra, something so there's some Chukumachu super Poincaré algebra with some central charges and with an R symmetry. Okay, so this is essentially means that I have only the central charges that are compatible with having an R symmetry. I guess in principle you could have massive choo-choo theories where you turn on every kind of R charge, any kind of central charge. And you break all R symmetries. But apart from the fact that I'm not aware of examples like that, because I want to do some categorical or homological sort of calculations, I want to have a fermion number. An integral value fermion number, which is provided by the half charge. And I'm looking at brains which preserve this half charge as well. So the typical example or prototypical example for what I'm doing is Landau-Ginzburg theories on CN or perhaps on the Calabi-Yau and their A-brains. Or perhaps nonlinear sigma model or gauge linear sigma models. Something like the CPN sigma model, say, and their B brains. So essentially, these are the brains which preserve the same supersymmetries, the same types of supersymmetries as the BPS particles of your theory. And the main philosophy behind what we do is that we want to study properties of these theories which do not depend on the detailed ultraviolet description of the theory. We only want to use a low energy language. Everything we say should be stated in terms of long distance, low energy degrees of freedom. So in terms of these theories will have a certain set of massive vacua, this assumption, and then there will be some BPS particles which saturate the BPS bound. And we want to do as much as we can just using information about these BPS particles. Now, so I mentioned the BPS particles, so let me add some extra detail to this blackboard. So, as I said, one of the basic assumptions is that these theories have some finite set of massive vacuum. And typically, I denote your typical vacuum as I or J. Okay, so lowercase Latin letters. And the central charge the central charge is defined on the states of your theory. So on the line, when you specify a state on the theory on the line, you have to tell me what lives at which vacuum lives at infinity on the left and on the right. And the central charge of a state is typically written as this. So for a generic massive theory, which has twisted masses, there is a term that comes from which has some flavor symmetries and associated twisted masses. The central charge can get a contribution from the flavor symmetries. And then there is a topological contribution, which knows only about the choice of vacuum on the left and on the right. Now, although our formalism can probably be applied to situations with twisted masses, it makes it very cumbersome. So for now and for the rest of the talk, I'm just turning off the twisted masses. So in each sector, there is a BPS bound. The mass of the excitations which live between vacuum I and vacuum J is bounded by the central charge. And there is a certain set of BPS particles which saturate the bound. So this BPS particles sit in some multiplet of states which just come from basic dynamics, meaning a particle can have some momentum, some zero mode, some momentum. These particles break some supersymmetry, so there is some fermionic zero mode that lives on these particles, so they come into a multiplet of states of the supersymmetry algebra. Let me just, for now, ignore that multiplet. And then they come in with multiplicities, meaning that in general there might be several different BPS particles which live between vacuum I and vacuum J. So let me denote the space of BPS particles, the vector space of BPS particles, as something like this. So typically what people study when they study wall crossing are the Witten indices of the spaces of BPS particles, something like So these integer numbers are rather interesting. They have, so they can be computed in a very direct way in a specific UV description of your theory. For example, in Landau-Ginzburg theories, they correspond to some gradient flows from true critical points of your superpotential. And they have some nice wall crossing properties, which are elucidated by Cecotti-Vafa several years ago. Now, there is a sort of compact way to express these wall crossing properties, which is the following. So each BPS particle comes associated with a central charge, as I said, in particular with a certain phase of its central charge. So if you draw on the complex plane the vectors which correspond to the central charges of these particles, and then at each vector, you associate the matrix with a single non-zero of diagonal entry, which is given by mu ij. Let me call this Sij. Okay. So if you take a half plane can take the product of all the Sij's inside this half plane counterclockwise or clockwise, whatever, in the order of or the phase of the central charge. Denote the half plane corresponding to some direction theta, sh theta. Okay, so you take this product, s theta. And the statement is that as you do a wall crossing, as you change the parameters of your theory, okay, the number of BPS particles can jump. It jumps if and only if sure these direct arguments pass across each other as you vary the parameters. But as they pass across each other, so the individual mu ij's might change, but the product will remain the same. So this is the Chakotay-Wafa wall crossing formula. So the product of these matrices remains the same as you change the parameters, unless one of these rays comes out of your half plane, but that's a more trivial event. So as I was saying, we came to some sort of a categorification of this wall crossing formula. Instead of understanding how the mu ij's change, we would like to understand how the vector spaces themselves change. So in particular, these vector spaces have gradient by fermion number. You might want to construct some affine invariants which take trace of y to the fermion number over rij. You might ask, how do these numbers change as you vary the parameters of your theory? Or in general, how do these vector spaces vary? And so our conclusion at the moment has sort of three levels of refinement. So the first level, so let me just build a vector space version of that product. So let me take the product of we take this sort of product. So essentially, so this is a big matrix of vector spaces. Okay, no, just not like this. So the first claim is that we can equip these vector spaces with some differential. Make some nice complexes. And then when you have a wall crossing, so you have two values of the parameters and you have your vector spaces and differentials for different values of the parameters, these two complexes are related by a chain map. So the cohomology of this complex is supposed to be invariant on the wall crossing. So there will be some maps which commute to the differential. Okay. So the first level of the categorical wall crossing is just the statement that instead of these numbers, instead of just the cohomology, the Euler character of this complex as being the same as you cross walls of marginal stability, that there is differential such that the cohomology of these complexes remains the same as you cross a wall of marginal stability. So this is the first level. So you take the product, the same kind of product that you see here. So you take some half plane, you make the product in the order of the arguments of the central charge. So over all the particles, such that the argument of Zij lives in the half plane.
So inside the parentheses is what? Vector space?
Yeah, it's a vector space. This is, I guess, I could write it like this.
What is Z?
The integers.
It's a vector space over what?
Maybe I should just put things over the reals for now. For Landeryev-Bout theories, all of these vector spaces are defined over the integers. I'm not sure this is true for a generic Chouchou theory. Maybe not.
It's a direct sum?
Direct product.
No, sorry, plus.
Yes, sorry. So let me give a concrete example.
You didn't yet say what the differential is.
No, indeed.
Okay.
So for now I'm saying there is a way to construct the differential from the data of the theory. Mm-hmm. I will discuss it, hopefully, during the talk. And then this becomes true. And there is a way to define these maps, to get a chain map. But let me just give a few examples. So, okay, the first trivial example is this thing with Shuvakya. Okay, something like a Landeryev-Bout theory with cubic subpotential. Okay, so this is Shuvakya given by x squared equal to a. So x equal to plus minus root of a. Okay. So the central charges I was mentioning are the values of the subpotential in these critical values. So something like minus a to the 3/2 or plus a to the 3/2. Okay. So in this case, things are pretty boring. There is only one arrow, one pair of arrows in your complex plane. And there is only one factor. And there is no wall crossing. You know, there are only one true particles, and nothing happens to them as you change the parameters. Now, a slightly more interesting example is a quartic subpotential. Now you have three vacua. Okay. Now you have three vacua, which are the three roots of A. Now you have BPS particles, central charge. This is a subpotential thing. So a picture like that. So you have three elements in this product. And as you vary the polynomial, the subpotential to some more general quartic polynomial, okay, it's possible to have a situation where two of these lines come together. So these three lines come together and cross each other. This happens when the critical points of the subpotential will be aligned. Okay, so and on the other side of the wall of marginal stability, you got a situation where there is just two lines in each half plane. Okay. So there is only a particle, say 1, 2, and 2, 3. And this side was maybe 2, 3, 1, 2, but also 1, 3. So the standard wall crossing formula is essentially the following identity. Means that, so if I take, I hope I get it right. So on this side, you're trying to take the product over this line. So you get something like, you know, 1 plus E 1, 2, 1 plus E 2, 3. Okay. This product of two matrices. This means just the 1 at position 1, 2. So you take your product, you get 1 plus E 1, 2 plus E 2, 3 plus E 1, 3. On the other side of the wall, you get something like 1 plus E 2, 3, 1 plus E 1, 3, 1 plus E 1, 2. And now all the products between these little matrices are 0, and you get again 1 plus E12 plus E23 plus E13. Now, the categorification of this, okay, what would it be? So on this side, we have R plus R again, because so there are one-dimensional spaces of BPS states plus R. So there is sort of a diagonal matrix R. You're in that with something that has. So this was a matrix which was 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, okay? And now instead you have a matrix of vector spaces, R. So a matrix of one-dimensional vector spaces. And so here there are no sort of no interesting constellations, okay, no differential to worry about. On the other hand, if you take a different half plane, okay, then we will crossing format becomes slightly different. So here there is a 3-2 line, the opposite central charges 2-3, and has BPS degeneracy minus 1, because it's always true that mu ij go to minus mu ji. Okay. So now the formula is not like the product is not like 1 plus e 1 1 plus e 1 1 minus e 3 2. Okay, so we can start doing products. We get 1 plus e 1 plus e 1 2 minus e 3 2, and then there is a product of this one and this one, which gives me minus e 1 2. Okay, so the level of matrices, what do? We just erase these, and we say that this is the same as we would have gotten from the half plane here. Sorry, I didn't do it. Probably didn't do it very. I mean, on the other side, I should now global crossing with these two paths across. But the point is that at a categorical level, now here we have what this means is that I have a one-dimensional vector space, a one-dimensional vector space of Fermi number 0, and then here a one-dimensional vector space of Fermi number 1. That's why there is a minus 1. And now I have this constellation becomes a situation where I have, you know, a five-dimensional vector space, but there is an element of fermion number 0 and an element of fermion number 1, which I want to cancel against each other. So here I'll have a differential. I need some sort of differential to make this match what you get on the other side of the wall of marginal stability. So the first statement is that there is some data in your theory, your massive theory, which allows you to build up the differential. And then some wall crossing formula that tells you how this complex change. Now, the second level of the wall crossing formula is that both this that this differential is just the first element of a whole tower of operations. So this differential maps something like that. And then there are other operations which are multilinear. So maps say R hat ij tensor a hat jk into a hat K, hang on, R of Vij, Kt, then map R hat, that's R hat, that's R hat, into R hat. Etc. So there's infinite tower of higher operations. And these operations satisfy the axioms of an infinity algebra, meaning that if you sum over all possible ways to write something that looks like this, with appropriate signs, you get zero. And the same way, the maps that are involved in world crossing also become part of some infinite family. Etc. So they will map. So the first map was mapping the arcs on one side of the wall, the arcs on the other side of the wall. The second map will map the tensor product of two on this side of the wall to that on the other side of the wall, etc. And these maps give an infinity morphism, satisfy the axioms of an infinity morphism. Something like sum of D F. Okay, so in short, I'm saying that there is a whole algebraic structure that can be given to these spaces of BPS states. And this algebraic structure is transported in a natural way across a wall of marginal stability. Third level has to do with how this interplays with brains. So there is a statement that if you take a brain, a supersymmetric boundary condition in your theory, you can map it to a twisted chain complex for this infinity algebra. What does it mean? It means that you get so that the brain will have some infrared Champaton factors, some vector spaces associated to each choice of vacuum of the theory, a collection of some vector spaces, and a map, which I could call V or Vij, which sends Ij okay, and so this map satisfies sort of a matrix version of a Mercator-Cartan equation. So sum of so if you take Dij Sorry, instead of a map, let me just write it like this. Sorry. So it's an element of this space. Okay. So you see, these sort of things can be composed. You can take, for example, you can define the ij of B, ij in a simple way, you just act with D on R. Okay. Then you can define dijk on B. Ij bik, where the map acts on the Rs, and you sort of contract this object as matrices for the Champaton set bundles, meaning that you contract the epsilon star j of this guy with the E star j here with the E j here. Okay. So the result is some gives in again in some EI that store I have. Anyway, so you can add this up over all your operations. Okay. If anybody here has seen the string field theory, this might ring a bell. Or it's called the Morey-Cartan equation. Or for mathematicians, it's a is a condition for a twisted complex. Anyway, the claim is this is zero. So every brain gives you a solution of this equation. And in a sense, this solution contains all the information, all the supersymmetric information about this brain in the infrared. So this is sort of the infrared image of this brain which was defined in the UV in your theory.
So can you give an example in the Landau-Hintzberg model?
I hopefully will get to something like that, but. I think I can give an example for the.
Model, you have these are A brains, I suppose?
Yes.
So these are the brains which start at the back one. And
yes.
These left sheds.
That's right, that's right. A good way to think about this is that the brain.
But this has, and this has epsilon I equal to 1 at one vacuum.
That's right. So for the thimbles, so these are not the only brains, right? As already figured out some time ago. Landau-Hintzberg theories, there are all sorts of A brains. The thimbles are just some particular beautiful examples of A brains in Landau-Hintzberg theories. Because even in one-dimensional Landau-Hintzberg theory, you can take any Lagrangian some manifold which ends at infinity in a place where the real part of the subpotential becomes negative. And that gives you a brain. Now, each of these Lagrangians can be, at the level of Ramon-Ramon charges, each of these brains can be written as a linear sum of thimbles. So indeed, this statement is essentially telling you that you are studying the brain, which is a direct sum of thimble brains with Champaton factors. So you take a bunch of thimbles, you put Champaton factors on them, and then you deform it by some tachyon, by some open string mode.
Yes, okay. But in the infrared, you're going to condense these tachyons.
So, right. So, what does it mean?
Well, the tachyon in the.
Remember, these are not conformal field theories. These are massive choo-choo theories. So. Nothing.
But you said you wanted to go to the infrared anyway, right?
Yeah, so in the infrared, what do you have? The thimble is a trivial boundary condition which only allows you to have a specific vacuum of the theory.
Yes.
But you can have boundary conditions which. I mean, any boundary condition in the UV
is still a valid sum.
Well, if the form, you started this and you deform it by this open string mode.
What does that mean? Well, you have to say what that means.
Yes.
So what is this means you're adding it to the, this means you're imagining you're adding this to the, I mean, the brain is still a boundary condition in the.
No, so I had some, I'm just saying that from some point of view, from some, as long as you are, so there is some brain defined in the UV.
It's still a boundary condition.
Yes. I'm saying that as an element of some derived category, okay, that brain behaves much as a direct sum of thimbles deformed by some.
Okay, but now you want to go to that was the UV definition, but now you want to go to the infrared, right?
There is no.
So
every brain in the UV gives you something in the infrared.
Yes.
That something will be captured by this data. These vector spaces and these amplitudes.
So what is the R?
Well, it's what you we called essentially is the number. This is the space of ground states of the system on a half line. Right. So the EI is just a space of supersymmetric ground states of your system on a half line with your brain at
the
end. A vacuum I, and this gives you EI.
A brain also.
So you put a brain.
There's also a vacuum.
Yes, you put a vacuum at infinity.
Ah.
And this gives you a system.
I is not the level of brain, but.
A vacuum, exactly. No, that's right. So you get a collection. This I always labels a vacuum. So for each vacuum of the theory, you get a vector space. And then you get some algebraic objects, which I'll describe momentarily. And I claim that these algebraic objects satisfy Morel-Cartan equation, which in a mathematical context, it will be called the twisted complex, meaning you take a bunch of objects and differentials, and then the differential is composed to the A infinity relations composed to zero. So this is sort of an infinity generalization of saying B squared equal to zero. Okay. B squared. Okay, so right, so and so this okay. So there's this data attached to every brain. Okay.
So and you can have two brains. You're just talking about one. Same brain?
Yeah, so let me take some brain.
One brain.
So I have some brain here. And this produces some data, the collection of Champaton factors and this amplitude. Okay. Now you could do the same on the other side of the wall of marginal stability. You would get a different collection of Champaton bundles and data. Now, and if you're just looking at the world through the glasses of the Witten index, so if you're just studying the traces of minus one to the f of these spaces, which is what we call the frame BPS degeneracies with Moore and Knightsken, then across the wall of marginal stability, I mean, there are some nice interaction between these guys and the mu ijs. So these guys occasionally jump, and they jump in ways controlled by the mu ijs. And now I'm just claiming that there is sort of a categorical version of the statements. So, for example, the map, somehow this map maps F up here, in a sense, make this diagram commutative. Actually, we believe that if you have your favorite ultraviolet description of brains, say a Foucault Seidel category, this map should actually be a morphism of infinity categories. And these morphisms that we define sort of make the diagram commute. So there is a map from the UV to the IR. This map depends on where you are in the parameter space, but the dependence is intertwined by this wall crossing data.
Mm-hmm. May I just ask, just to clarify for me as a mathematician, so do you understand correctly that you start with the category of the Foucault category of involves, then
okay.
you make it into a triangulated category by considering
mm-hmm.
complexes. And so when you cross the wall of marginal stability, it's just a mutation on that category.
That's right.
And this Rij, are they just Kakamoto? I mean,
well, so if you were doing Foucault category, you'll be using intersections. You take your thimbles, you would deform them a little bit, and look at the intersection numbers, right?
You can take the direct sum of them. Yeah, and take this algebra, if you consider
yes. So the spaces that are defined like this are not exactly the number of intersections of these slightly deformed thimbles. So, but it's true that they're Euler-Carter is the same, for example. So this is not exactly the Foucault category because, you know, really the underlying space is different. But it's related to it by some infinity morphism.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. But importantly, right, so these guys, so the guys that appear in Fakai Asedel are not subject to the sort of world crossing. They're subject to, there are two kinds of walls, right? There are walls where the lines pass across each other, and there are walls where the lines get out of your half space. So the mutations you're talking about have to do with going out of your half space.
You just stay inside of the half space.
But staying inside the half space, there are still walls of much stability in this setup, because this setup is based on this degenerate system. But somehow the intersection of Timbos is, does not know about this walls of much stability.
Check one more thing. So you said this Rij hat there,
yes.
But the Bij, this is the open spin. That, yeah.
Yes, roughly speaking, yes. It's an analogy, okay? This is happening in the infrared. I'm saying if this infrared structure was, if you take the formula and you interpret them as UV statements, then this would be the usual statement that you have some dark category with an exceptional collection. You can build everything at twisted complexes for this exceptional collection. So there is it's analogous to that state.
Yeah, but what I want to ask is actually, you're taking these open string calculus, but they're somehow pulled back from this Rij hat, right?
Hmm?
They're obtained from this Rij hat.
Yeah, so in a sense, this is the Holmes or the X.
But they were defined initially as spaces of BPS particles.
Yes,
okay?
That's correct.
And in particular, there's an interval structure.
Yes.
Well,
now
you have
at least for Landau-Greenberg theories, yes.
So you're now claiming there's an interval structure on the space of open string.
Yes. I'm not sure it survives in the UV, right?
Mm-hmm.
So down here it exists. But I don't know, in the Fakai Seidel, for example?
This is not known at all.
Okay. So definitely for Landau-Greenberg theories, in the infrared structure there is integrality. So everything is integers. These maps are really counting solutions of some equation. This is probably due to the fact that Landau-Greenberg theories can be sort of lifted to three dimensions. But I'm not sure this is true for generic choo-choo theories. It might not be.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's sort of the question. I mean,
but most, I mean, a lot of, you know, if, say a CP1 sigma model has an Orivafa mirror, and that Orivafa mirror definitely has integrality.
I mean, in this particular case, it seems to me it still comes from this business with the thimbles, right? This integrality, doesn't it come from?
Yeah, it comes from the fact that
it comes from the thimble. No, I mean, it comes from the correspondence between vacuum and thimbles, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, it comes from the fact that the BPS states have integrality.
The correspondence between BPS states and open strings and morphisms.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where does that come from?
Well.
See, I mean, this is not something you expect in general. For
no, indeed. So this is some. This is not some. So I'm just gonna. So I define some quantities which you could, are, you know, defining the infrared that gives you this gives you this structure. But, they're not open strings in any sense.
No, but they're morphisms between objects in the category which you call frames. Okay.
Yes. That is true.
AKA open string. Okay. But anyway.
Fine, okay. So, how does this structure come about? So it comes from asking a relatively harmless looking question, okay? So take your theory and put it on a segment. Okay? And pick some boundary conditions, supersymmetric boundary conditions on the left and on the right. Let me call it the left brain and the right brain. No. Okay. So this system preserves two supersymmetries. Each brain is half BPS, and they preserve the same supersymmetry. So this is pretty much an analog of supersymmetric quantum mechanics. It's one, you know, it's a system evolves in time, it has two supercharges, it has, so all the states of the system are, which are not ground states, are paired up, and then the ground states are not paired, And if you do the Witten index, it's a very robust quantity that only looks at Gang states. And you can do a little bit better than the Witten index. You can do the cohomology of the supercharge. Okay. And the cohomology of the supercharge looks at the Gang states. Okay. So you take your Hilbert space of the system on the segment. You do the cohomology with the supercharge. And you're supposed to get something nice, the set of exact ground states of your system. Now, this is a robust object, so I can take this segment to be small, I can take it to be large, I should be getting the same answers. If I take it very, very small, this is a UV calculation. So you take whatever you would do in your favorite Fukuyama category or derived category, you would compute some home or some x, I don't know, you would get some vector space. But what happens if you try to do the calculation in infrared? So if this is a very long segment compared to the mass scale of your theory. What is the ground state of this system? Well, at least approximately in a massive theory on a very long segment, I should be able to say that first of all, I pick a vacuum. Okay? And then I ask, what is the ground state of the system? Yeah, how do I get my system in a ground state on the left? And how do I get it to a ground state on the right? In other words, there is the approximate ground state of this system. We call it the space of approximate ground state of the system, which is the sum over the choice of vacua of the ground states of the system on the path line. So this, I'm defining HS as the exact ground state of the system on a half line. Okay. So what is the relation with this approximate ground states and the exact ground states? So, supersymmetric quantum mechanics reminds me of Morse theory, the idea that somehow you get a set of approximate ground states which correspond to the critical points of the Morse function, and then you want to correct that, and then correct it by taking the expectation value of your supercharge between your approximate ground states, and it gives you a differential. And somehow, if you look at the cohomology of these approximate ground states with respect to this differential, this should give you exact ground states. So what is this differential physically? What sort of things can contribute to the differential? Which sort of processes or instantons will contribute to the differential? So notice that for a massive theory, we expect that these sort of states, if they're not exact ground states, they're gonna have an exponentially small energy. Because the only thing that can push the energy up is some sort of massive object that moves from the boundary to the other. These two boundaries are very far away, they need to talk to each other. The theory has no massless degrees of freedom, they need to talk to each other to exchanging a massive particle. So the differential should somehow encode the communication between the left and the right side to massive particles. And because this is a supersymmetric setup, I would expect that only BPS particles matter. So my prototypical process that contributes to a differential will be something like this, where my system was sitting in some vacuum I in the bulk, and then in the past, in the future, sits on some vacuum J. And to go from vacuum I to vacuum J, there must be a BPS particle of type IJ, which propagates through the system. I want this to be supersymmetric. I'm trying to find the matrix element of a supercharge. But so I need to understand a little bit better how can I place BPS particles in this picture in such a way that they're supersymmetric. So I need to go back to the supersymmetry algebra, which of course I've erased. Anyway, so the brains preserve a vertical brain preserves the supercharge of the form, of this form. Okay, so these are the supercharges which are preserved by a brain, where zeta is some parameter that you pick when you choose your brain. Okay. I can take just pick to be one for now. So I can suppose these are the two supercharges that are preserved by the brain. On the other hand, a soliton, a BPS soliton, preserves a supercharge which looks a static BPS soliton, stationary. Because a supercharge that looks like this. Suppose you take your static soliton, you boost it. Okay? Let's work in Euclidean signature. So if you boost your soliton, you make it go on a sloped trajectory, then essentially you get something like e to the I half, e to the I, well, you get the rapidity here. You get e to the I alpha minus I alpha, where alpha is the slope of this line. Which means that if you adjust the slope of the soliton so that it coincides with the phase of central charge.
So you're doing a boost?
A boost, yes. And
why is it a phase?
Hmm?
Why is it a phase?
Well, it's a boost, but in Euclidean becomes a phase.
Oh, Euclidean.
Yeah. So in Euclidean, because I'm looking for an instanton, so I feel, okay, what
is
this?
So this is not a real time.
No, that's right, this is an instanton. Euclidean time. So this means that if I adjust the phase, I can actually preserve one common supercharge. Okay. If I don't know if anybody you have encountered things like quarter BPS webs at some point. This is the situation. You take some half BPS strings, lines. You adjust their phase so that it agrees with the central charge phase, adjust the slope so that it agrees with the phase of central charge. And then you can combine them to make quarter BPS objects. So in Chukumachu means that you have four supercharges, and now you reserve one common supercharge, which is what you need for an instanton. So say in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, an instanton is some configuration of the field which preserves one supercharge. That's what contributes to the most differentials. So that is the sort of configuration we're looking for. So the instantons are BPS particles which move along the phase of the central charge. So this is an example of a process which can give a differential. Okay. And I'm not sure how much time I have, but maybe I'll leave it for later. But once you start looking at this process, of course, there is no end to it, because you can say, okay, what if I had a picture like this? That's also a BPS web. Okay. I could have a soliton which splits into other two solitons. It's doing the wrong thing. And maybe it's more complicated. Maybe there are processes where two solitons are emitted. In principle, every web that I can write on the strip has a chance to contribute to my differential. So I should let it. So the only constraint, again, this talk really would require a review of most theories before the talk, but that would take another hour. So I cannot do that. But as in most theory, the instanton that contribute to the differential are the ones that have fermion number one, which comes from having one fermionic zero mode, which comes from having one bosonic zero mode. So the instantons which contribute to a process are only the rigid instantons, things that can only be moved in time, but not, they have no other moduli. This, for example, is not a rigid instanton. I could move this vertex to the left or to the right. If I have some rigid vertex here, and rigid vertex here, I could get something like this. This would be a rigid instant. So my differential, conjecturally, should be a sum over the rigid strip webs, rigid webs on the strip. Okay. Now, how do I compute the amplitude for this instanton? Well, very roughly, there will be some amplitude to some sort of scattering amplitude, some low energy effective action for the BPS solitons that tell me which numbers to put here and which numbers to put here. Okay. These are things that somebody very powerful could compute given the UV description of the theory. From the point of view of the infrared physics, these are just God given. Okay. So to compute the amplitude, I just take a product over the interior vertices. Or some amplitudes. And assemble and some, so there will be some amplitudes on the left boundary which encode the properties of the left brain, some amplitudes on the right boundary that encode the properties of the right brain, and some boundaries in the middle which encode the properties of the theory. So it will be a product of interior vertices, product of left vertices, product of right over right vertices, or some algebraic objects, some amplitudes to emit particles. Okay. And the question is, okay, I'm given this mess, how could it ever be nilpotent? Okay. I have some complicated object, some sum of all possible rigid webs or some data attached to the brain. And, well, you know, I change my parameters of the theory just a little bit. Some webs can appear, some webs can disappear, who knows. How can this always produce a nilpotent differential? So the answer is that BPS webs actually have some beautiful algebraic structures that allow you to recast the equation, the square r equal to zero, to a bunch of simpler equations, which only involve local processes at one boundary or in the middle or the right boundary. So there are a bunch of relations which can be which, if satisfied by this bulk or boundary amplitudes, will guarantee that the differential is zero, is nilpotent for every choice of brains on the left and on the right. Okay, so these axioms for the brains look exactly like something like that. And then there is something similar for the bulk amplitudes, which involves an L-infinity algebra. So the magic, so you sort of get some equations like this, where the thing that goes inside the argument, the thing that solves the equations, is the product of some complicated UV calculation. Okay, from the point of view of the infrared, is just given by whoever was studying the theory. But the containers, the function, the coefficients of these equations, those depend only on infrared data. They're just some combinatorics of webs. They're produced by some combinatorics of webs. And magically, they still satisfy beautiful A-infinity algebraic relations. So there is sort of some infrared algebraic structure, which only depends on very basic data, like the Schoeffer central charges, that defines whole categories, you know, as solutions of some Rekhlaffian equations. And then the UV data, the UV objects are going to sit inside these categories. There are going to be some maps from the UV objects to these algebraic structures in the infrared. Now, I don't know how much time I have. But I would like to give a very basic example of how these algebraic structures emerge. Not even in the, right, even just for the bulk theory, not even for brains. So let's study BPS webs in the plane, which means, so as I said, I have a bunch of numbers which are the central charges. I want to draw pictures like this. Okay. Where each segment, so in each face, I have a choice of vacuum. Okay. And each segment should have the phase of the corresponding central charge. So if the segment between I and J should be aligned along ZIJ, ZI minus ZJ. Okay. This is my definition. This is a BPS web. Whatever picture you write like this, I call BPS web. So BPS webs can have moduli. Some webs will be completely rigid. Some webs can have one modulus. I call them taut. Some webs could have two moduli. Okay, clearly. So here, clearly, you can move things like this and preserve the BPS condition. Here, you could move it like that in two directions. You could have something like this. This would also have one modulus. This would have two. Right, because we can move it in two ways. So what is the moduli space of a web? Well, there's always translations. I forget about that. But typically, it looks like, for example, if I have one modulus, the moduli space of a web typically is an R plus. Okay, I can make it as big as I want, but if I try to make it small, at some point, two vertices collide. Or here, it's something like a quarter of a, I mean, it's R plus times R plus. I sort of have the distance of these two edges. I can make each as large as I want, but if I can try to make them small, they two vertices collide. So what are the... what are the boundaries of a moduli space of webs? So if you think about it for a little bit, you realize that, so as I said, only thing that can happen is that two or more vertices are forced to collide. So near a boundary, a BPS web will look like some big configuration. And then a bunch of vertices are forced to come together by the BPS condition. So there will be some region where there is a small web. Okay. Now you can argue that somehow the moduli spaces. So this is a nice configuration. You can imagine, look at this outside thing as just one web, one BPS web by itself in the limit, in which you've taken a vertex and you've resolved it by inserting a smaller web inside. So BPS web is a sort of convolution operation. You take a bigger web, you take a smaller web, you insert the smaller web inside one of the vertices of the bigger web. And it's easy to see that the moduli spaces of these webs are actually composed in a nice way. So the dimension of the moduli space of the resulting web is the product of the dimensions of the moduli spaces of the container web and the small web. In other words, you can parameterize the space of webs near the boundary by just moving the small web however you want and moving the big web however you want. Particularly if you're looking at the codimension one boundary, it means that the small web must be taut, must have only one modulus. So the picture that you see here is always something like this. So, let me define the taut element as a sum over taut web, over webs with one modulus. So literally, you take some, you define some vector space which is one generator for every web. Okay. And you add together these start webs. Okay. As I said, so webs can be convolved. You can insert a web inside another web. So you can ask what happens if you do the convolution of if you sum over all possible ways of convolving two webs with one modulus. So the case is a web with two moduli. As I said, the moduli space of webs with two moduli is typically something like this, which has two boundaries. Now, there is a way to adjust the signs to define the composition with signs. Essentially, you ask if the moduli space, you assign an orientation to the moduli spaces of web, and then you ask if the orientation of the convolution agrees with the convolution with the product of the orientations. And if you use that, if you introduce signs like that, it turns out that the left boundary and the right boundary contribute to the sum with opposite sign. So the sum over all possible convolutions become a sum over all possible webs with two moduli. I mean, all possible boundaries of the space with two moduli, because all spaces look like this. Left and the right boundary cancel out. In other words, you end up with something like an identity like that. Now, later you can try to introduce operations like this sort of evaluation of an instanton amplitude, meaning if you start attaching BPS particles to your lines and inserting amplitudes inside your vertices. Okay. So you start defining some sort of an operation which takes a web and a bunch of amplitudes and gives you an amplitude. And you can define an operation by sort of summing over all tau webs. And this sort of identity, once you unpack it, ends up being something like, so you define some operation T that takes on some vector space, which I don't have time to define very well, but it's sort of, well, maybe I should. Okay, sorry, let me do it like quickly. So that's it. So these webs are at a certain number of edges that go at infinity. Okay? So morally speaking, a picture like this wants to represent an element in the tensor product. Of these four spaces of BPS states. Meaning I can, if I'm given an element in the tensor product of these and these, an element in the tensor product of these and these, I can sort of contract these legs and get an element in the tensor product of these, and these. So every web gives me sort of a linear operation which takes things that live at the vertices and spit out things that live at infinity. Okay. And so if I define this operation by summing over all possible tau webs, this sort of identity ends up giving you an axiom of this form for this operation. And it's actually something called an L-infinity algebra, sort of a commutative version of an A-infinity algebra. And then you repeat the exercise for webs that live in a half plane. Okay. And you ask, how do these webs become small? All right. So how do these webs degenerate? So here, you might have some small subweb in the bulk, or you might have some small subweb in the boundary. You end up having some identity where this is the sum of the taut webs over the half plane, and this is the sum of the taut webs in the bulk. And this gives you some other algebraic structure involving an operation T an operation T H and so on. So you get nice algebraic structures associated to these webs. You get them for the webs in the plane, webs in the half plane, webs in the strip. You get a bunch of convolution identities for these webs, for these BPS webs. You convert them into linear identities, and you start getting sort of L infinity axioms, A infinity axioms, or whatnot. And you discover that if you have solutions of equations like these attached to each boundary, you get a well-defined differential on the strip. Now, perhaps I can. Okay, one last statement is, so of course you could ask why, from the point of view of ultraviolet theory, would I ever get this sort of equations? So if you think about Landau-Gisbert theory, for example, okay, so if you have a Landau-Gisbert theory and you're studying the problem on the segment, you could do things exactly in the full Landau-Gisbert theory. Instantons would be solutions. So the ground states of the system would be solutions of some soliton equation. And the instantons that you use to find the differential would be solutions of some instanton equation. Okay. And you try to solve this instanton equation on the strip. And again, you can ask what happens to the solution of this instanton equation on the strip when the strip becomes very big. And the claim is that it starts looking like that, where these ones are solutions, you know, smooth solitons of your Landau-Gisbert model. And these are sort of local solutions of this equation, either in the plane or in the half plane. So now you start asking, okay, why? So the way you define this sort of beast is by counting local solutions of the Landau-Gisbert theory instanton equation on the half plane, say. And now you can do things a la Morse theory. You can ask, okay, suppose I look at an instanton that has two moduli, so time translation and some other modulus. And I look at how the instanton looks like at the end of its moduli space. And the claim is that it's going to look like that. So at the end, near the end of moduli space of instantons, I found an instanton which looks like a bunch of solitons coming together in a web. So this axiom becomes a sum over endpoints of moduli spaces of instantons. And because this moduli space of instantons are nice and smooth, they're always lines. Endpoints always come in pairs, and they cancel out if your signs are right. So this is just a sum over all possible endpoints of an instanton moduli space. Near each endpoint, the instanton looks like a web. So I can count the number of endpoints by looking at the number of local solutions and the number of webs in which I can insert them. And the arguments are the local solutions, and the coefficients are the webs. So essentially, in the paper, we just apply over and over and over and over again the Morse theory idea of looking at moduli spaces of instantons with one modulus and derive identities either for the webs or for the amplitudes. And you keep repeating this. You know, if you want to study wall crossing, you look at the configuration where the parameters are changing in space, and you look at how the webs look like in these, you get maps. Right. So the details are not as bad as they look. As far as I understand, right, this should apply to any massive choo-choo theory. N. Yeah. Yes, sorry.